Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. You know, look around you, whether we're talking about healthcare costs going up or the future of pensions or how unemployment benefits affect the job market, the welfare state, it's always in the news. And almost always, the discussion is just so polarized.
Oh, absolutely. It's always framed politically, isn't it? People tend to see it either as this economic black hole dragging down the free market or, you know, a social safety net that can never be quite big enough. The nuance just gets lost.
Exactly. So today, we are kind of skipping that tired political battlefield. We're diving into David Garland's really profound work, The Welfare State. Our mission here is to shift the frame. You know, we want to unpack his core insight, which is that the welfare state isn't just a collection of expensive policies, but is actually a resilient, complex, and, well, fundamental social institution, a form of modern governance, really.
Yeah, and if you want to move past the usual soundbites in any debate about, say, social risk or taxes or collective security, you really have to understand this institution the way Garland explains it. It's essential.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. Why is this study so relevant right now? I mean, today. Because, well, societies are grappling with these huge issues, right? Like climate change hitting housing, automation changing jobs, populations getting older, and the structures that provide security, our taxes, our pensions, insurance programs, they're all being seriously challenged. So understanding the history and function of the welfare state, it's kind of the key to understanding what's really at stake in today's reforms.
It gives you that context, definitely.
Right. So let's introduce the mind behind this powerful analysis. David Garland. He's the Arthur T. Vanderbilt Professor of Law and Professor of Sociology at NYU. He's incredibly distinguished, obviously, but here's where his background gets really interesting, I think.
Yeah, what's fascinating here is that Garland didn't come at this like a typical economist or, you know, a policy expert. His earlier major work, things like The Culture of Control, focused on criminology and the penal state. So social control, punishment, exclusion.
Huh. So he started by studying institutions designed to manage deviance, to sort of keep people out of mainstream society. Mm. So what happens when that perspective looks at institutions designed to bring people in? Does linking state support to state punishment, does that imply a kind of pessimistic view of welfare?
You know, it's not really pessimistic. I'd say it's comprehensive. Mm. He sees the welfare state as the necessary counterpart to the penal state. It's two sides of one coin. So if the penal state manages social deviance through exclusion think jails, courts, the welfare state manages dependency and collective risk through support and inclusion. They're both fundamental to modern governance, managing risk and populations. And this dual expertise, it lets him do this really powerful institutional analysis. He shows how both systems define and manage what it means to be a citizen.
Right, shaping citizenship itself.
Yeah, exactly. So Garland's central idea, his premise, is that the modern welfare state is this truly transformative mode of government. He calls it an ingenious solution, actually, something advanced society sort of had to invent because industrial capitalism, well, it created enormous wealth, sure, but also these massive destabilizing social risks, things like mass unemployment, debilitating sickness, industrial accidents, old age with no savings or family support. Mm-hmm. The state basically had to step in to maintain stability.
And that intervention, that's what gives us this sociological lens, right? We're moving beyond just looking at dollar amounts or specific policy details and zooming out to look at the deeper stuff, the social, cultural, political dimensions. How did this whole structure actually change what it means to be a citizen in the 20th and 21st centuries?
Yeah, and his definition is key here. He defines it as a state that takes explicit responsibility for securing the basic well-being of its citizens. And crucially, this is done through national legal bureaucratic systems. That's what makes it completely different from, say, old local poor relief or just charity. It essentially makes security a right, something codified in law, and it's woven into the fabric of pretty much every advanced industrial nation.
Okay, so if we look at the structure that grew to meet this responsibility, Garland points to two main pillars. Things that often get mixed up in everyday debate. Let's clarify those. The first one is Social Security.
Right. Social Security, in the broad sense Garland uses, focuses mostly on income maintenance. So basically cash transfers, designed to replace income you lose because of specific predictable life risks, losing your job, becoming disabled, retiring.
Okay. And the engine often driving this pillar is social insurance. So hang on. If I contribute to a state fund while I'm working, and then I draw from that same fund when I, say, need surgery or I retire, mm-hmm. that means my benefit is a right based on my contribution history. Is that it?
Precisely. That's the critical difference. Because you paid in, you have an entitlement. It's not a handout based on proving you're poor. It's a collective contributory right. This is really where that idea of risk pooling comes into its own. We all chip in.
Got it. Okay, so the second pillar then is social services. This isn't cash, it's the direct in-kind provision of goods and services.
Exactly. This is your public education system, maybe a national healthcare service like the NHS in the UK, or social housing programs.
Wow, that really highlights the sheer scale we're talking about, doesn't it? The management task.
Huge. This whole operation runs through these vast, rational bureaucracies. They use statistics, data to anticipate and manage risks at the population level, not just dealing with individual crises as they pop up. And it creates this powerful reciprocal obligation. Citizens contribute, maybe through taxes, maybe premiums. And in return, the state guarantees a certain floor of security and services. It's a two-way street.
This whole system, it sounds like this massive, enlightened, progressive project, you know. So here's where the history gets really interesting, because it wasn't initially like that at all, was it? If you go back to the late 19th century and the unlikely father figure, Otto von Bismarck in Germany back in the 1880s.
Yeah, Bismarck, a deeply conservative chancellor, right? Focused on state power, national unity, stability, definitely not worker liberation. And yet, he introduced the world's first comprehensive compulsory social insurance, covered sickness, accidents, old age.
Why? I mean, what was the motivation for this conservative leader to do that? Seems counterintuitive.
Well, it was political pragmatism, pure and simple. His motivation was basically twofold. One, foster loyalty to the relatively new German state. And two, maybe more importantly, undermine the rising socialist movement. He wanted to prove the existing state could offer worker security, maybe even better security than any revolutionary party was promising. And this strategy established what we call the corporatist earnings-related model. Your benefits were directly tied to your status in the labor market, preserving those hierarchies.
Okay, wow. So state building and anti-socialism.
Hmm.
Now, contrast that conservative political move with the vision that shaped things later, especially in the English-speaking world. I'm thinking William Beveridge in the UK, his 1942 report, that became the blueprint for the whole post-war system there, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Beveridge represented a complete pivot. He pushed for a universalist, citizenship-based model. Unlike Bismarck's system, which kind of preserves status differences from the workplace, Beveridge argued for protecting all citizens universally, from the cradle to the grave, as the famous phrase goes. His goal, famously, was to slay the five giants: want, disease, ignorance, squalor, and idleness, a much broader social vision. And that kind of thinking gave us systems like the Universal National Health Service. Everyone's in just by being a citizen.
That's a huge difference in philosophy. So if we connect all this history, this evolution, to the bigger picture, Garland makes this, pretty radical claim. The welfare state isn't some revolutionary anti-capitalist force trying to overthrow the market. He says it's actually a crucial partner to capitalism.
Yes, it's essential stabilizer. That's a key part of his argument. It corrects for market failures, you know, things the private market either can't provide or won't provide adequately for everyone. Think universal education or maybe environmental protection. But maybe more profoundly, it acts as an automatic economic stabilizer. When a recession hits, things like unemployment benefits kick in immediately. That boosts aggregate demand, keeps money circulating, prevents deeper market collapses, and helps maintain social peace. Plus, it educates the workforce, keeps the labor pool relatively healthy, basically creating a stable environment where profit-making can continue.
Okay, and this leads us to what feels like the big sociological aha concept in Garland's analysis, this idea of the decommodification of labor.
Right. It sounds a bit academic, decommodification, but the idea itself is simple and really insightful. What it means is that the welfare state gives individuals a degree of independence from the sheer raw compulsion of the labor market.
Okay, help me understand that practically. So let's say I lose my job. If I have a state pension I can eventually count on, or unemployment insurance kicking in now, or maybe subsidized healthcare, it means I don't have to instantly grab the very first, maybe terrible, low-wage job that comes along just to survive, just to feed my family. The state provides a floor, a basic level of security
Right.
that gives me some breathing room, some dignity.
Exactly that. It means your basic existence isn't entirely treated as just a commodity that has to be sold on the labor market every single day, no matter the price. This security gives workers a bit more bargaining power. It ensures they're less vulnerable to total desperation, and that leads to a more just society, and ironically, as Garland argues, a more stable capitalist society too.
Right, stability again. Okay, so what is this institutional approach, looking at it as this big social structure? Tell us about society today. Let's maybe highlight three core takeaways that really shape how we should view all those welfare debates we hear about. Theme one, seeing the welfare state as social architecture.
Yeah, this shifts the whole conversation. It moves away from just asking, can we afford this policy, to asking, how does this structure actually shape our collective life? Garland argues the welfare state embeds certain assumptions about reciprocity, about collective responsibility right into our everyday experience, how we plan retirement, how we think about healthcare. It functions, as he says, and this is one of those core ideas, not as an optional accessory to modern capitalism, but its essential built-in partner. The two systems, capitalism and welfare, are just deeply codependent. You can't really have one without the other in their modern forms.
Okay, codependent. Theme two, then, is this really essential link between welfare and citizenship. You touched on this earlier. Every discussion about welfare rules eligibility. It's fundamentally a discussion about who belongs, right?
Absolutely. Welfare systems are inherently political because they define who's included in the community, who might be excluded, and on what terms you can claim social support. It's powerful when you think about it. As Garland puts it, and this is another key quote, welfare systems embody particular conceptions of social citizenship, defining who belongs to the political community and on what terms they can claim social support. So every debate about, say, benefit eligibility for immigrants or who deserves housing assistance, that's really a debate about national identity, about the boundaries of our community, who counts as us.
That really reframes those often technical-sounding debates.
Okay.
Finally, theme three. This idea of adaptation and resilience, we've heard for decades, right? Ever since maybe the 1970s, the oil crises, the rise of globalization and neoliberal ideas, that the welfare state is in permanent crisis, that it's about to collapse under its own weight.
Yes, the crisis narrative is constant. But Garland offers a really crucial corrective here. He acknowledges there has been transformation. Welfare systems often did become more conditional, more targeted. There's been more focus on linking benefits to work requirements, for instance, welfare to work. But, he argues, the core functions managing risks, ensuring social stability that were just too essential to abandon completely, its durability is actually remarkable. So the crisis isn't a terminal illness. It's more like a permanent condition of negotiation, of adjustment over its form and scope, which leads to his other key point. The politics of welfare are ultimately about competing visions of the good society and the proper relationship between individual responsibility and collective support. It's always contested.
Competing visions of the good society. That makes sense. Okay, so this knowledge, this framework, it's highly practical for you, the listener. How can you use Garland's framework to analyze the world around you today? Application one, critically analyzing policy debates.
Right. So when you read about some policy proposal, maybe a plan to reduce public pensions or privatize a public service like water or healthcare, you can use this framework to see it's not just a technical budget measure. Often it's a fundamental ideological shift. It might be moving away from collective risk pooling, where we all share the risk of getting old or sick, towards individualized risk, where basically only those who can afford private solutions are truly secure. It helps you see the kind of hidden agenda, perhaps, behind the financial numbers.
That's useful. Application two, understanding why countries are so different in their approach.
Exactly. Garland helps explain why the U.S. system, which is often more means-tested, more fragmented, looks so different from, say, the Nordic systems, which are highly universal, or the German system, which is more corporatist, linked to employment. It goes back to those initial historical choices we talked about, whether they followed more of a Bismarckian path or a Beveridgean one. The political culture shaped the structure way back when, and that structure continues to shape the lives of millions today. It's not just about economic cost.
History matters. Okay, and application three, which might be the most personally significant for many listeners. Understanding the invisible architecture of your own security.
Yeah, think about your own financial planning, your life planning.
Understanding how state provisions, things like retirement pensions, public health investments, maybe job loss insurance, how they function as this often unacknowledged foundation for your life. That understanding means you can make better decisions. Knowing that the system provides some kind of baseline security, however imperfect, it actually allows people to take calculated risks sometimes. maybe in their career, starting a small business, moving for a better opportunity. Because total desperation is, hopefully, mitigated by that safety net.
It's part of the background stability we often take for granted.
Yeah. You know, for me, I think what truly surprised me most reading Garland was how he reframes that whole argument about cost. Seeing the welfare state not as a drain on capitalism, but as this essential maintenance feature for capitalism, that felt like a real shift. And also, those conservative Bismarckian origins, the fact that it was partly born from political self-interest, not just pure idealism, that really hammered home the idea that this is a pragmatic, likely permanent feature of modern states.
Yeah, that's powerful. For me, I think the core takeaway is that the welfare state, in whatever form, is basically an institutional expression of social solidarity, some level of, we're in this together.
Yeah.
And maybe that inherent sense of solidarity, however contested, is what makes it nearly indestructible, despite all the crisis talk. The debate is really just over the nature and extent of that solidarity, recognizing that this political struggle over its future form is constant, it's ongoing, while it means that we as citizens are constantly involved in defining the kind of society we live in and defining the moral obligations we feel we have towards one another. That's the real ongoing conversation.
A constant negotiation. Well put. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.